Monster Man, special episode, Shapeshifters.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon supporters. And in particular, of Patreon supporter Sam. If you'd like to be like Sam and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, in addition to getting to choose a topic for a special episode, you'll get the rewards for all other levels, including all new episodes of my other podcast, Patron Deities. So Sam, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Sam has asked me to talk about shape changers in RPGs, and in particular, the motif of finding a shape changer. To establish a little bit of the question, I will quote from Sam's email, in which he says, "In stories, shape changers are often uncovered because they have a telltale sign, such as a kitsune having to hide a tail. How do you make this work in a game?" Sam also raised another point, which I will return to later on. So before we begin, let's set some parameters. There are many kinds of shape-changing monsters, but I think that we are going to mainly focus on two. The question, I guess, is whether we are presented with the monster and trying to find the person, or whether we are presented with the people and trying to find the monster. So the first case is your basic lycanthrope or similar, a human or human-seeming character who becomes a monster, whether intentionally or at certain times or due to a curse or whatever. So the premise of the detection story here is we were attacked by this creature. It must be someone in the village, but who? So there we know there is a monster, we just don't know who it is. Your second detecting a shapeshifter story is the more seductive version, like the jackalware or like various tricky spirits that we've looked at lately, like hags in many cases. In this case, the detection story is, "Don't look now, guys, but I think there might be something fishy about this beautiful maiden hanging out in a ruined temple in the middle of the night looking for adventurers." There we're presented with a seemingly normal person, and the question is, how do we detect whether that person is a monster? Now, although they're obviously two somewhat different scenarios, these two things have a lot in common, and I'm going to propose that the easiest way to handle the second one is to turn it into a little bit more of the first. I'll come back to that. You would think that both of these would be quite easy to present, but I maintain that it is actually harder than it seems. I think the first one's easier to pull off than the second, but they both have their challenges. For the first one in general, I think you want to lean into kind of folk horror or gothic horror tropes wherever you can. So what I would do is kind of like treat the shapeshifter as a legend. So this is something that people know about, but the PCs kind of have to learn about it. This works for version 2 as well. And this is fun because it means that you get to like talk to an old wise woman who says, "No ordinary wolf attacked you. Let me tell you the tale of the werewolf." Or if you're, you know, guarding a caravan or whatever, the caravan merchants can like fill your heads with traveler's tales about how ghouls lurk on the road, but you can always tell them because although they change the appearance of their faces, they can't change their feet or whatever it is. So now that you've heard the grandmother's story and you know that werewolves, don't have belly buttons, let's say. So you got attacked by a werewolf and now you need to find out which of the villagers is the monster, which means you have to come up with a way to arrange to see all of their belly buttons. As you know, how do you sneak a look at every tummy in the village without everybody thinking that you're some kind of belly button weirdo? This works best, as all of these stories do, in social contexts where the PCs can't just do whatever they feel like. Although you could have a fun adventure in which somebody who can do whatever they feel like, some kind of witch hunter or local lord or town bully or whatever, is causing a lot of trouble in the town looking for the werewolf, and you know, you need to find the creature basically in order to end the disruption that this person's search for the monster is causing. You know, some innocent person could be being accused of being a werewolf by some meathead who doesn't really understand what the monsters can do. Shapeshifting stories in general work well in contexts where appearing like a normal person is good protection. So if the shapeshifter blends in as a villager and that basically makes it immune to harm because villagers can't just go around murdering each other or storming through the village in a big pitchfork and torch-wielding mob. Or at least if they do, it's a big deal. Whereas if you're in a kind of lawless wilderness situation where a beautiful maiden awaiting passersby in the ruined temple is as likely to be shanked as a jackal monster, then it's less useful to be able to seem like an innocent person if being an innocent person is no kind of protection. So dealing with the second case, where a monster has changed into the form of a human, like in order to kind of tempt people, is a little more difficult because it usually, in the folk tales, this usually relies on some kind of visual cue. You know, that could be like the kitsune always has a tail, or the ghoul can't change the shape of its feet, or pod people don't have belly buttons, or maybe the monster can't, like, shape change its shadow or something like that. But this is a problem of the medium, because visual cues are difficult to present in what is essentially an audio medium, role-playing. This is assuming that we're not talking about LARPs here, etc., etc., but visual cues are difficult to represent in an audio medium without essentially you just telling the players what's going on, right? So that visual cue, unless you're very, very, very subtle, amounts to the GM either telling or not telling the players, which is to say, deciding whether they figure it out. You know, the PCs may not be paying a lot of attention, but the moment that they hear that the lonely hermit that they've met in this cave has goat feet, the jig is up. In his email, Sam mentioned the idea of doing something with scent, which I think would be interesting, because here you can structure a kind of secondary clue, and this, I think, not to give too much away, I think is how you need to approach the visual one as well, by which I mean, like, you could make sure to describe how the shapeshifter's lair is full of clouds of incense, or how powerful the smell of its perfume is. And so this allows you to have secondary clues and also a certain types of red herrings. So by a secondary clue, I mean a piece of information that points to the main clue. So the, like, chemical reek in the alchemist's lab is both a description of what an alchemist's lab is like, but also a reason that you might not have noticed the characteristic scent of a pod person. And so later on, perhaps, when you hear that, oh, pod people all, you know, smell like flowers or whatever it is, then you think, well, who in this village smells like flowers? We haven't met anybody who smells like that, except for Auntie Janice. But that's just because she's such a keen gardener. And the fair Gwendolyn, but that's just because she wears a lot of perfume. And old Dr. Bronken, but then, you know, as an alchemist, his lab all smells like chemicals. If he might have smelled like flowers, but we wouldn't have been able to smell them. So this is the most satisfying kind of clue, because you can give the PCs information that lets them know that something is up, and then they kind of take action to conclude things themselves, rather than you just presenting them with the conclusion. Another way to do this is to tell the PCs about the telltale signs for multiple monsters. This is really helpful if you have like a chatty old wise woman or a traveling merchant or someone who's heard a lot of tall tales. I keep thinking of, I know I recommended before, but if you're interested in kind of Middle Eastern stories of these creatures, I would recommend looking at the Twitter feed of Dr. Ali Alomi, who talks a lot about magical beliefs and folklore and stuff like that in kind of the Muslim world. So given that this is mainly an audio medium, another way to approach the problem would be to replace the visual cue that identifies the monster with some kind of verbal or behavioral cue. And that could be as simple as, you know, vampires can't come out during the daytime, or werewolves only eat meat. Or it could be a generic one, you know, boggarts can't speak the names of the gods. Or if you're building up a recurring villain who's capable of shapeshifting, which is something that Sam talked about in his email, then you might give that monster a distinctive verbal or behavioral tick of some kind. So, like, man, we really have been running into a lot of people who like to quote classical poetry lately, haven't we? Wait a minute. So have some distinctive thing that that character does, like talk about themselves in the third person, or end sentences with yes, or not use contractions, or whatever it is. And then when you do that as that NPC, the players can go, huh, this kind of sounds awfully familiar. There is a problem with this. And, it, you know, you have to know your own performances and the sort of general awareness of your players in order to really deal with this. It's going to be unique to every group. The problem is that it is a lot easier to spot discrepancies in the behavior of real people than it is in a performer playing a part, right? If you're the GM and you are playing, you know, 10 different NPCs in a session, then naturally some of them are going to sound alike, right? They sound alike simply by virtue of the fact that they're all played by the same person. And so your PCs can be forgiven for thinking that if more than one of your NPCs has a particular behavior or says a particular thing, this might just be because, you know, they are in fact the same person, not because in the game they're the same person. An alternative to giving the monster a special tell is to give the monster a special way of being seen. So perhaps the monster's true appearance will be seen if it is seen by moonlight. It's an example that Sam mentioned. Or maybe if you sprinkle the powder of Ibn Ghazi into the fire, then the light will reveal the true nature of the monster. Or maybe you have a particular pair of sunglasses that lets you see past illusions and see the real monster. You know, something like that. Or I mentioned before the idea of a monster being unable to shapeshift its shadow. Or maybe it can't shapeshift its reflection. Something like that. So then, again, this is good because it puts the detection mechanism back in the hands of the PCs. They can be trying to arrange situations where they can meet old Dr. Bronkman. That wasn't his name before, but whatever, you know, by moonlight, or where they can get their hands on some of the powder of Ibn Ghazi. So this gives you more options in terms of making the monster's, you know, detection playable. So this is assuming that we're looking for a monster in disguise among characters that we just met. That isn't the same as a monster impersonating a specific person. Now, again, this kind of depends on the NPC's characterization. And just like with the verbal cues or whatever, part of the problem is that realistically, most NPCs are not characterized in that much detail, right? You might notice a little change in the behavior or vocabulary of a real person, but that's harder with someone you see more rarely for less time and who is one of many characters played by the same person. And you can't be too subtle in playing these differences, and you can't expect people to pick them up the first time they encounter them. As an aside, I've always wanted to do that in a LARP and kind of have the solution to like a Call of Cthulhu live game be a Scooby-Doo thing, because of course in Scooby-Doo a person wearing a monster costume is indistinguishable from a real monster, and also in LARP that's the case because that's what a quote-unquote real monster looks like, is a person in a costume. So you know, you're used to fighting some person in a mask, and then it actually turns out to be some person in a mask. Another point that Sam raised in his email is that player characters in general tend to be a little more unrestrained in how they deal with situations like this. Because of course, they're not dealing with real-world consequences, either in terms of being punished for their behavior or in terms of the other effects of their behavior. So if you run into a beautiful maiden in the ruined temple late at night looking for adventurers, and you think to yourself, oh, okay, this is a jackal wear, and, you know, you shoot her with a silver bullet, and she just falls down dead, but not because of the silver, just because of the bullet, you realize, oh, I've just gunned down an innocent bystander. Obviously, that's very bad, but it's a lot worse in real life than it is in a game, right? Because, you know, she's not a really real person. She wasn't actually harmed. So it doesn't have the same kind of moral weight. And also, there are a lot of games where treating the lives of NPCs as, you know, kind of inconsequential is not that unusual, right? PCs are more willing to take wild risks in a role-playing game than people are in real life, which is a good thing in terms of creating adventure fiction, but it does mean that when you shift the genre into mystery, you have to be a little more careful. Now, my experience is, and your mileage may vary, but my experience is that players tend, in general, to be pretty excited about the idea of participating in specific genres. So if you put out the signals that this is a kind of gothic horror mystery moment where the goal is to identify the monster rather than kill it, in my experience, most will play along. They like to do a little mystery every once in a while, even if it's not a mystery game. A murder mystery is one of those sessions you can drop into a campaign every now and again, and I think the PCs think it makes like a little, you know, it's a nice change. Again, every group is different, but that's my experience. You know, most campaigns are going to have like a Magnificent Seven session, and most campaigns are going to have like a Murder on the Orient Express session at some point along their line. If you're concerned about it, I think there are a couple of ways to deal with it. The first is to have the player characters be acting on behalf of someone who has asked them specifically to identify the monster. So if they've been told, like, that they will get a reward if they find out who's the werewolf, but that they will not get a reward if they, like, shoot the local priest with a silver bullet and he turns out not to have been a werewolf, or indeed even if he does, then, you know, they'll understand that those are the stakes and they'll probably play along. Another thing to do is make it possible for, if you're dealing with like a lycanthrope type situation, as opposed to your kind of shape-shifting villain, you can have the curse be breakable in some way. So they're not going to just gun down the werewolf because they know that if they can like infuse them with, you know, Wolf's Bane tonic at the new moon, they can cure them of their curse. Well, then they might be interested. It might also be the case that that NPC has something they need. So even if they, you know, think they have a pretty good idea who it is, they probably won't just stab them. I am, as you probably know, loath to recommend just imposing in-game consequences, because in-game consequences don't typically have that kind of out-of-game effect in my experience. And I'm not that excited about running Fighting the Cops the RPG, which is what typically happens when players decide to go on a crime spree. The fact that they might get arrested and sent to prison does not motivate them not to do any more crimes after the first one. It motivates them to fight the cops. It's also, I mean, I should also ask, is it necessarily so bad if the players are a little rasher about who they identify as, you know, the jackal wear? Like, maybe that gets them run out of town on a rail, but it's possible that this actually contributes to their sense of victimization at the hands of the jackal wear, right? Like, if they're constantly wondering who is their nemesis, Dr. Jackal wear, you know, which of these people is actually their, you know, secret enemy, they may start to get a reputation as being paranoid, and that can be good, right? It, you know, if Dr. Jekyllware's goal is to, like, destroy their lives, then having people think that they're a bunch of violent, paranoid people gives them more motivation to vindicate themselves, to clear their names. It's kind of a Daredevil and the Kingpin kind of situation. It was a nice piece of work, Dr. Jekyllware. You shouldn't have signed it. I do think that, you know, this is dealable with if you want to. So, for instance, one thing you could do would be to give the PCs, you know, an amulet that lights up when they press it to that kind of monster, or a chemical that turns purple when it's exposed to that kind of monster, but that they can't just like run around waving, you know, that it only works a certain number of times. And if it gets a negative, well, then it has to like recharge for such and such an amount. So what you really want is to like set up a situation where you're pretty certain that this person's the Jackalware, and then you hit him with the Jackalware amulet. And if they're not, then they just go, why are you weirdos poking me with your amulet? And if they are, then it's Jackalware fight time. So I guess what I'm saying is that there are a number of different approaches, but precisely which one you take is going to depend very much on your group and how they like to handle these types of conflicts. Like, ultimately, if they're going to find it frustrating, or if they're going to just, like, stab everybody they see, then maybe this isn't the right plotline for that group. Not every plotline is right for every group, and that's okay. But I think if you can establish the genre boundaries that say, okay, now we're dealing with a whodunit mystery, now we're dealing with some spy versus spy type of stuff. Well, maybe not spy versus spy, but you know what I mean? Some spy hunting kind of thing. We're trying to figure out who's the mole without tipping our hand. I think you can get away with it. That, actually, having mentioned that, that is the other thing to do, right, is if you accuse the wrong person, then Dr. Jackalware will realize, uh-oh, these people have rumbled me, and then, you know, the next day you'll find out that the old innkeeper has left town, and then, like, you turn up the real innkeeper's body in the backyard, and you've missed your chance to bring Dr. Jackalware to justice. I realize that I am describing these D&D monsters as though they were comic book supervillains. Shapeshifting is a very supervillainous power, and it often goes with villains who have some kind of other problem with their sense of identity or something like that. I don't know that that's necessarily something you want to pursue with Dr. Jackalware. Like, how much of Dr. Jackalware's kind of personal characterization matters is, you know, that's going to vary from game to game. But I do think that there is room to kind of have a little parallel thing going on with Dr. Jackalware, where as they shift between identities, they may in fact sort of start to genuinely sympathize with them. What if Dr. Jackalware shapeshifts and like lives among the people of this village and realizes that they're being like cruelly exploited by the evil lord and actually thinks, you know, like there's something really ought to be done about this person? It might even be that Dr. Jackalware, in disguise, would recruit the PCs to help. Like, after all, if they're the doctor's arch nemesis, then at least the doctor has a certain kind of grudging respect for their prowess. You know, someone who changes sides or changes their loyalties often, a kind of chameleon, you know, shape-shifting is a very, like, metaphorically appropriate power for them. So those are just some thoughts on how to implement a shape-shifting monster in the kind of, like, mystery monster hunt sense, rather than the kind of like shape-shifting monster where, you know, it's a pixie and it's going to polymorph into a T-Rex in order to fight you, right? There's a certain kind of shape-shifting that is a power fantasy about being whatever you want to be, but it's not really about concealing your identity, and so I'm not including those shape-shifting monsters in this discussion. But for the shape-shifting monster that, like, adopts a false identity, I think those are some ways to make an idea that in some ways doesn't actually work super well in role-playing games more practical. All right, and I think that that is about all the time that I have to talk about shape-shifting monsters today. Sam, I hope that you've enjoyed this episode, and I hope it has been helpful for you. I know Sam has been thinking about implementing a recurring shape-shifting villain campaign. Spoilers for Sam's campaign, I guess. You know, so I guess if any of your players listen to my show, you should probably tell them not to listen to this one. Although it's sadly not actually a Dr. Jackalware. But yeah, I hope that you enjoyed it, and I hope that you found it helpful. Everyone else, as always, if you'd like to be like Sam and get your own special episode, remember that all you have to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, we're going to be returning to Monsters Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. So I hope that you will join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.